Have to be out of here like by 4 o'clock at the latest, so we go until we finish. But it is my pleasure to introduce Bomson Jun, who's sitting here. He is, you can read about him in the bio. He is from Seoul, Korea, and a man of many talents indeed. He received his master's in history writing about Thomas Paine, and actually, some of the quotes that were read from Professor Clinton, The International Mind, reminding everyone that in the 1838 Declaration of Sentiments by William Lloyd Garrison, he uses the phrase, "My country is the whole world, my countrymen are all mankind," which actually originally comes from Thomas Paine. Without further ado, I will introduce Bomson, and he is going to be discussing the last item in your booklet. If nobody has, does somebody need the booklet? Anybody? There are some extras up here. So the last essay in the booklet is by Hum Sok Han. There's a banner there, "Put Your Sword Down and Think Hard." Hum Sok Han was a Korean peace activist and democracy activist, philosopher, poet. I learned about him during my time as a Fulbright scholar in Korea from Pak Gwangik, who's sitting in the back, a student who introduced me to the Korean Quaker, Hum Sok Han, who actually spent some time in Philadelphia and at the Pendle Hill Quaker Study Center. So, Bomson, thank you.
From Korea. I actually flew here from Seoul last weekend to talk about Hum Sok Han, of all people, at the Masonic Temple, of all places. And I found that rather peculiar, as has been my interactions with Hope for the past 10 years. She has a very peculiar interest. And as we have all experienced, yesterday we talked about Lucretia Mott and the women's rights movement and the abolitionist movement. And all of a sudden we're talking about the K-drama today, and Hum Sok Han. And I was given the rather formidable task of explaining the title of our event, Toward Unity, and it says in Korean, 하나 됨 에로. It's all in your, what do you call this? Lanyard, or yeah. It's written there in Korean. And as a Korean myself, I found that was very interesting to have that expression written here. It's not a very casual expression. Only a philosopher would say this, but extremely meaningful. So my job is to explain 하나 됨으로, toward unity, and why Hum Sok Han said that, and why Hope put here. Because she just told me that I had a hard time explaining to potential sponsors about the connections, the threads that's linking Hum Sok Han and all the other people that we have been talking about here since yesterday. In order to talk about unity, I will have to begin with division and the divisive world we're living in right now. I was born in Gangwon-do in South Korea, which is the only divided province in the only divided country in the world. I was born in 1991. And growing up, I had this very extreme frustration at the division of the country. Not out of some noble, you know, spirit, not out of some patriotic will, but because I was forced to go to military. I knew that since growing up as a boy in Korea, I had to serve 2 years in the military. And I'm a rock and roll musician right now. But growing up, I had that spirit too. So military was the last place I wanted to be in. So that sort of kindled my interest in history and to figure out why on earth this country is divided, and why on earth I had to be dragged into the military to waste 2 years of my life, which I eventually did. That curiosity, that sort of fundamental frustration at the division of Korea, led me to study history I wanted to understand how Korea got to be divided in 1945, and how Korea had to go to war, a civil war between the North and the South in 1950. And in order to understand that, I had to understand the foundation of the Republic of Korea. And who made Korea? The United States. Which is why I came here in 2010 to study history in New Hampshire. I read history with a focus on colonialism and nation building, just trying to understand how America got to create Korea and, you know, how I came to be. I did 3 years of that, and the more I studied it, I realized, you know what? If America made Korea, England made America. The UK made the United States, in a way. So, which is the reason why I went to England in 2014 to do a master's on Thomas Paine, of all people. So my pursuit of my roots, to answer the question of why on earth is Korea divided, and I'm trying to not use the vulgar language, why I had to be dragged to the military, led me to England, and to this man called Thomas Paine. Now, you'll probably see where this is going. Thomas Paine, reading about Thomas Paine, this English Quaker who was extremely disillusioned with his own country, who left England in 1774 with a recommendation letter by Benjamin Franklin, came to Philadelphia, wrote Common Sense, which is still the best-selling book in all of American history in proportion to the population. He was the one that convinced the other founding fathers, who was merely just trying to not pay tax, to actually turn that into a revolution, a democratic republican revolution. It was common sense to him. He just came from England, monarchy, the church didn't make sense to him. He saw a continent, huge continent, being ruled by a small island, and he was like, you know what, guys, it's common sense. Declare independence. And that he did. His friends and he did. Friends like Jefferson and Washington. And in this city of Philadelphia was where Thomas Paine wrote and published Common Sense. And here was the beginning of the American independence. Now that only explains half of the reason why I'm here in Philadelphia. The other half relates to another disillusioned revolutionary that came to Philadelphia about 100 years later. His name was Seo Jae-pil. As a 20-year-old Korean aristocrat, Seo Jae-pil staged a failed coup d'etat in 1884. He tried to reform Joseon dynasty in a somewhat modern or Western manner, but he was only 20. And his coup d'etat led to basically the slaughter of his entire family. He could only save himself thanks to the help of the Japanese. He sneaked out of Korea, went to Japan, and with a friend, with the help of his friends in Japan, he could manage to travel to San Francisco, where he met a American philanthropist who put Seo Jae-pil into a school in Pennsylvania. So in 1885, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he traveled to Pennsylvania and started going to school here. He eventually became the first naturalized Korean American in 1890. He became a medical doctor, and he did his best to adopt to the American way of life until he was called back to the Korean court in 1895 as the advisor to the same king, who slaughtered his family, but was now, 10 years later, figuring out that, look, actually we need to reform a little bit, and we need to get the advice from this Korean-American. Seo Jae-pil had, by then, changed his name to Philip Jason. This was intentional turning of his name backwards. He hated his own fatherland, for obvious reasons. So he made a point of completely revolutionizing his name backwards and entered the capital of Korea, Seoul, with an American wife and an American bodyguard with an American citizenship, calling himself Philip Jason and refusing to bow to the emperor or the king at the time. He did a firm American handshake. He made the point of wearing the glasses in front of the king, which was considered to be not okay at the time. He founded the Independence Club and he published the Independence, the first Korean English bilingual newspaper in Seoul that advocated reforms for democracy and potentially a republic. You will probably see the continuity of Tom Paine's spirit in A Korean Man. Now, he did that for 3 years, but he was met with a huge backlash, and the king was again not happy with this guy, and Philip Jason left the country, blamed everything to the Koreans in English. He intentionally conversed only in English to his Korean friends. Now, since then, for 20 years, Philip Jason was left only with contempt for Korea. He saw no hope for reform. And it was only in 1919 that Philip Jason, who had been operating a business called Jason & Co. in Philadelphia, he ran a small sort of a business selling furniture and other goods. The only reason he started to see hope again in Korea was because of the March 1st movement. The March 1st movement, if you guys aren't aware, is a nationwide movement where a million people, among 20 million Koreans, came out to the streets, took to the streets, waved flags, the Korean flags, peacefully, calling for independence. This was an answer to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points at the Paris conference, who argued for the national self-determination, and the Korean people understood this as the American support for the Korean independence and came out to the streets very peacefully, just waving flags, saying, we want national self-determination and independence. This was ignited by the Declaration of Independence by the Korean leaders. 33 Korean leaders had signed the Declaration of Independence on March 1st. This was obviously also a continuation of the American Declaration of Independence, which was the first declaration of any independence in history. And Philip Jason saw that as the sign that finally Korea is waking up. Finally, there's light in Korea, and the people are mature enough, or at least desperate enough, to call for independence. So he sold his company, Jason & Co., or at least he started to fund the Korean Congress. The first Korean Congress was convened by Philip Jason just across the street from here at the 17th and Delancey Street in April of the same year. That's where Syngman Rhee, the first president of the Korea, also joined with Philip Jason to genuinely start to design the Republic of Korea. The Provisional Republic of Korea, the Provisional Government of the Republic of Korea was formed thereafter. We all know that Syngman Rhee became the first president of the Republic of Korea in 1948. But really, when the Americans took over Korea in 1945 after they won the war against Japan, they had Philip Jason in mind as the preferred president. Only Philip Jason was humble enough to decline that offer. They thought Syngman Rhee was too anti-communist even to their taste. So I could only wonder what Korea would have been like if Philip Jason did take that offer. But in any case, it was in Philadelphia in 1919 that the spirit of Korean independence was ignited by Philip Jason. And it is with that in mind, that connection between Tom Paine and Philadelphia, and Philip Jason and Philadelphia, that those two renegades that left England and Korea respectively, searching for pretty much the same thing, freedom and democracy and peace, that brought these two men to Philadelphia. Now, it's with that sort of connection that I can finally turn to our man, Ham Seok-hun, and his essay, We Must But Cannot Resort to Revolution, in 1959. Ham Seok-hun was born in 1901 in North Korea, in what is now North Korea. Back then it was just Korea. He studied in Pyongyang under his mentor named Namgang, Lee Sung-hoon. Namgang was one of the main leaders of the Protestants in Korea. He was actually the leader of the Christians who signed the Declaration of Independence in 1919. The Declaration of Independence, the Korean Declaration of Independence in 1919, was a very impressive interfaith declaration. It had 33 leaders, as I said, of which 16 were Protestants. Namgang was the leader of these 16. And 15 were Cheondogyo or Donghak, which is a native Korean religious movement whose ideas are rather similar to Quakerism for reasons I would not go for too long here, but reform-minded Korean religious movement. And the other two were Buddhist. So the fact that these different religious sects came together to call for Declaration of Independence in 1919 was itself very impressive from a religious historical perspective. But it was under Namgang Lee Sung-hoon, the Protestant leader of the Declaration of Independence, that Ham Seok-hun acquired his basic religious ideas as a Christian growing up in what is now North Korea. And as a 19-year-old boy, he witnessed the March 1st movement. He saw his fellow Korean people coming out to the streets calling for peace under international law. This is something very important. This is arguably the biggest civil disobedience, non-resistance movement to date at the time. I said a million people took to the streets very peacefully. And they weren't, unlike Tom Paine, they weren't calling for a war against the Japanese. Although Tom Paine has some good reasons, but the March 1st movement was a intentionally and fiercely nonviolent nationwide movement. Ham Seok-hun saw that as the sort of the proof of the spirit of the Korean people, which Ham Seok-hun thought was a history of struggle, a history of suffering, was his understanding of the Korean history, rather like the Israeli history in the Bible, he thought. And after the March 1st, which unfortunately failed to guarantee independence for Korea, Ham Seok-hun went to Japan to study. He studied under Uchimura Ganjo, who was a leader of the non-church movement in Japan. Uchimura Ganjo had himself traveled to Pennsylvania in the 1880s, had a very life-changing exchange with some Quakers here, which radically changed his own religious views and argued for the non-church movement, which basically means that he was a Christian, but he did not want to belong to any specific organized church. It was under Uchimura Ganjo that Ham Seok-hun learned about Quakerism and his pacifist ideas. It was only in 1967 that Ham Seok-hun sort of declared himself to be a Quaker. He actually visited Pennsylvania in 1961 and stayed in Pendle Hill for a year. Even then, he wasn't officially Quaker, but as one of his Quaker friends told him, he was already a Quaker before he was a Quaker. His ideas, his pacifist ideas, was what led him to become Quaker, not vice versa. And it was Ham Seok-hun's, Ham Seok-hun wrote the essay that we hopefully all read, or I will summarize to you shortly, in 1959. It was titled, the English translation is titled, We Must But Cannot Resort to Revolution. That is the gist of what he says. But the original Korean was titled, 정치와 종교, parenthesis, 새 시대의 전망, which means politics and religions, prospects for a new age. And this was in 1959. And unlike Tom Paine or Philip Jason, Ham Seok-hun had experienced a trauma. Carrying on with the theme of PTSD in K-drama and the Tower of K-drama, he had witnessed perhaps the most traumatizing K-drama in recent history, which was the Korean War. As I said, he was born in the northern half. He was raised Christian. That meant he could not return to his hometown. And he could potentially, and he did never return to his hometown. And it was in 1959, only 6 years after the war, that he penned this essay, Politics and Religion. And I will try to summarize what he was arguing for. And you probably have the handout on you. He starts with the Gordian knot, which is the fable where the King Alexander, when he was traveling, was given this task of untying the Gordian knot. Rather, he just cut it through. You know, thinking outside the box, really. And Hamza Khan was arguing that, look, we need a revolution. We need to change politics, obviously. We can't afford to have two world wars and the Korean War and the Cold War, right? We clearly need to change politics. And it had to be just like how Alexander cut the Gordian knot. It has to be revolutionary. So I'm going through each of these chapters on his essay. The first is the Gordian knot. And that means we need to stage a revolution. But he was a diligent student of history, and I try to be one myself by studying the histories of revolutions. As I said, I wrote about the American Revolution and the French Revolution and Tom Paine's involvement in it. And although his spirit was quite noble, his revolutions, or all revolutions, I argue, fail eventually. All violent revolutions, at least, lead to dictators, as it did in the French Revolution, as it did in the Russian Revolution, as it did in the Chinese Revolution, as it did in the North Korean Revolution and the Cuban Revolution. All modern revolutions did. And Tom Sokhan saw that clearly. So he said, we must resort to revolution, but we cannot resort to revolution because all revolutions fail. And he was taking cue from Gandhi, who argued for alternative way, which is the nonviolent way to bring about the same kind of revolutionary political change. And why do all revolutions fail? It's the same reason as to why we need the revolution in the first place. Why do we need the political revolutions? Because of human nature, because of the politicians. This was in 1959. Syngman Rhee was reigning as a quite brutal dictator in South Korea, so Hamza Khan had him in mind. We know these old political class that rules not just Korea, but also all over the world, needs to go. But because of the precisely same reason, human nature, revolution is bound to fail. That's his argument. Because man is man, as he said. Which is why we cannot resort to revolution and we cannot let men be the judge of other men. Because man is not a god. And he goes into this distinction between politics and religion, which I think is the most important message I want to deliver to you from Hamza Khan. Now, the concept of the political versus the concept of the religious could be quite confusing. What's the difference between politics and religion? Sometimes it's one, sometimes it's not. Carl Schmitt, the Nazi legal philosopher that came out of the blue, defined the concept of the political as a distinction between friend and foe. That was the sort of fundamental definition of what the political means. To be political means to be able to tell a friend from enemy, which automatically leads to his Nazi conclusion where he can, you know, take over the enemy and conquer them in order to expand the territory, so to speak. According to Ham isn't explicitly talking about Schmitt, but basically it's the same kind of definition. For Ham, the political is a very horizontal thing. So he sees two axes. The horizontal is the political. The vertical is the religious. The horizontal, the political, is whereby you decide a friend from hoe, a friend from foe, excuse me. And to be able to tell the difference is whereby you can pacify the foes, the enemies. And that is has been the history of modern politics, history of modern imperialism, to go stretch over the land and the seas, conquer the enemies, or the darkness, or the barbaric, or the rest, whether that be in Asia or in Africa. That has been modern history, and that was what Korea was victim of. For Hamsa Khan, the religious was the opposite, the vertical. If the political was about stretching over, taking over, conquest, the vertical was about transcending, to go higher, to heaven. In the Chinese world, this is different. Like to be political is to pacify Chunha or Tianxia in Chinese, which literally means under heaven. So everywhere, all the political world is under heaven in the Chinese worldview. Whereas for Hamsa Khan, to be religious is not to pacify Tianxia or Chunha, but rather to go to heaven, Chenggup. So that he has a very clear distinction between the political and the religious. So according to that definition, no existing religious organization is really religious. They're all being political. Because any existing organized religion will have those distinctions between us and them, between friends and enemies. And for Ham, that is no religion. That is not being religious enough. So in a way, he's using a language that is not necessarily about peace or reconciliation or conciliation or amity. He's using the language of unity, which is rather different from peace or pacifying the rest of the world. Now, it is with this distinction that he brings in the Confucian origins of his ideas. That's quite mind-flexing for a Quaker. But he was not just limited to Western or Christian ways of thought. During his prison years, he read much of the Buddha or the Buddhist texts or the Taoist texts or the Confucian texts, and he wanted to create sort of a holistic, sort of a all-encompassing religious view. Now, how do we synthesize politics and religion? Because after all, if being divisive or binary is political, then aren't you doing the same thing by telling politics and religions apart? And here Ham brings in Confucius' idea of Zhongyong, or the mean. Zhong literally means center. That's the Korean pronunciation. Zhong is the Chinese. But the center is not that of a two-dimensional X versus Y, sort of Cartesian sort of plane where the X-axis and Y-axis meet. Rather, it's the spherical center. And this is where the original meaning of revolution comes into light. Because the word revolution comes from the revolution of celestial bodies, right? And the earth we're living on is also rotating or revolving as we speak. And that is the only reason why the vertical and the horizontal axis can form a one single being, namely the earth. That is why the east is ultimately the west, the north is ultimately the south. The binary division between the east and west is meaningless. I sort of experienced it myself by flying here. I thought I was going west to America, but I was flying east. And that's because we're living on a sphere. And Hamsa Khan was arguing for nothing less than this. Just less. Face the scientific fact and think spherically. Not be like those imperialists who drew the map and carved out the world and Korea on the 38th parallel and divided up into north and the south. Between the west and the rest. Or the free world and the unfree world or the communist world. By calling in for a spherical or as it is vogue in the philosophical circle these days, the planetary way of looking at things, he was arguing for a new way to synthesize politics and religion. Now, if you just go for the dialectical ideas of, you know, the two things forming into a new thing, that is always linear, right? You'll be able to synthesize the two, but it will lead to new divisions, new binaries, right? Hahn was arguing for a completely new way of philosophy and also to look at the world and, more importantly, to look at Korea and the division of the North and the South. This brings me back to my own experience in the military, which eventually did happen. It was for me either 2 years in prison or 2 years in the military. I opted for the latter. I served in as a KATUSA, which is the Korean augmentation to the United States Army, in 2016 to 2018. A KATUSA wears a U.S. Army uniform, is stationed at the U.S. Army base, which is legally speaking U.S. territory, even within Korea. And I was more importantly under the direct command, direct chain of command during Donald Trump's presidency. I spent 2 years at Camp Casey, which is by the DMZ, just looking at the North and surrounded by other American soldiers and insistently gazed upon by a certain portrait of Donald Trump and his red tie with orange hair as my commander-in-chief. And I was extremely confused. Because we had this question yesterday, what would Lucretia Mott think about the war in Ukraine? Right? I know what Henry W. Thoreau thought about John Brown. He was like, I support the guy, but I wouldn't do that myself. Which is what I actually did. He wrote about that. And I sort of found myself in the same position as Thoreau. I did not want to be part of this, but, you know, I think South Korea is a far better country to live in than the North. And if anything, the binary division between good versus evil cannot be more stark than anywhere else in the world. That DMZ, that division between the North and the South Korea, more so than Ukraine and Russia, between Putin or Biden, I don't know. Like anywhere, I would argue if there is anywhere in the world where we could be so clear about who's the good guy, I was pretty convinced that I was the better guy, or at least our team was the better one than the most totalitarian dictator in the world, namely Kim Jong-un. But even then, I was confused. Do I really deserve to be the judge? Am I really so much better than my fellow brothers and sisters in the North, especially the soldiers that are in the same position as I am? They have to serve 7 years, by the way. Women 7 years, men 10 years. I was just serving 2 years. So if we were to go to war against each other, I knew that I wasn't gonna kill them, any of them, even when they were gonna attack the country like they did in 1950. So this brings us to the importance of Hahn's ideas, especially in the 21st century, in the Anthropocene, in the age of the climate change, and also in the age of the new Cold War between the US and China. Two reasons. In the Anthropocene we're living in the age of the climate change, that is really the biggest war we're waging, humans against the non-humans. The biggest amount of violence that is done is to the non-human entities that we call nature. I argue the factory farming is the biggest crimes against humanity. And there is no justice in that. There is no peace agreement to be made between the Mother Earth and humanity. So when it comes to that, no binary division, no good versus evil, no light, concrete, darkness can mean anything when it comes to our relationship with the planet. That's where Hahn's sort of call for planetary thinking, the spherical thinking, where the polar opposites, the divisions, ultimately united in one revolution that is literally happening as we speak finds new meaning. That's a completely different way of looking at things that departs from the modern world look. And more importantly, with the new Cold War looming large, with the war in Ukraine and also the tensions rising up in Taiwan, we know, I know as a South Korean, that if the United States and China used to go to war against each other again, they would do that in Korea, just like they did last time they did. And Camp Humphreys, being the biggest U.S. Army base anywhere outside of the U.S., will be the first place to get, first place to be hit with anything if China is to go to war against the United States. And if the United States is to do anything, that would be the place to shoot anything from in the first place. So if we have a third world war, which will pretty sure be a nuclear war, it will definitely start in Korea. So we're, as a Korean, carrying on Ham's views and yearning to overcome that division, to transcend that division that is so fundamental to the political world we're living in right now. We have no other ways than to do this. Put your sword down and think hard. That is a rather simple sentence. And I found that very curious as to why Hope loved that sentence so much. Because we don't learn about that in the Korean history textbooks. We don't learn about Hamsakon in Korean history. And it is through Hope's work that I also became more interested in this particular sentence. But I think that sort of encapsulates the difference between what Tom Paine could resort to, but Hamsakon and I cannot resort to. In the 18th century, when the American colonialists were looking for independence from Britain, they could resort to the sword, and they did, under the leadership of George Washington. And I argue Korea is still not independent. Korea, I'm the living the testimony to that. Korea is not a sovereign country. The U.S. is. The U.S. has the power to command the South Korean army when there is a war. And there is still a huge American military presence in South Korea. So we had declared independence, but we had not achieved independence yet, just like the Americans did after the Declaration of Independence. It took them, depending on how you look at it, at least a decade, more so, than to finally achieve independence from the United Kingdom, but South Korea still hasn't. But can we resort to the sword against North Korea or Americans or Chinese? No, because the sword is now nuclear. For that same simple reason, the sword is now nuclear, and that is the mutual destruction, assured mutual destruction of not just Koreans, but probably all of us. So it is on that note that I want to conclude my summary of Hamsakon's argument, rather contradictory argument, but I think there is a paradoxical truth in that. We must, but we cannot, resort to revolution. And that truth, I think, is best encapsulated in nothing else than the Korean national flag, which happens to be put on the handout. Did you guys notice that? Or just me being Korean? That was so sensitive. Where's that picture? Yeah. Hope made a point of putting the Korean flag on the poster for this event. And if you guys aren't familiar with Taoist ideas, that is a symbol of yin and yang, the Korean flag. You guys know what a Korean flag looks like, the red and white in a circle, kind of looks like Pepsi, except without the white in the middle. And it is that flag that the Korean people waved in the March 1st movement in 1919. How did they make that flag? They just took the Japanese flag, which was abundant at the time, and painted blue, and put those dashes from I Ching around it. Now, that is the fundamental difference between the Korean spirit and the Japanese spirits, I would argue. I don't want to be so essentialist about this or nationalist or chauvinist about this, but that was the idea behind the designers of these flags. Now, Japan, or Nippon, literally translate to the root of the sun. That's why it's the country of the rising sun. That's why the Japanese Navy, the Japanese Imperial Forces, when they're conquering all of the Pacific and when they're bombing the Pearl Harbor, they had that flag of the rising sun, the sun beaming out these rays, right? By contrast, Korea, or Joseon, which is the original name of the Korea, literally means the land of the morning calm, Joseon. And I advise you, I suggest you to, if you can, go out on sunset, anywhere, preferably to the east, and try to see the sun when it's about to come out of the oceans. There's only twice a day, the sunset and the sunrise, where you can witness that beautiful balance between the red and the blue. The sun is the red, the lower half is the blue. The sun coming halfway out of the ocean is the Korean flag, is the moment of the morning calm. It's a very fleeting moment that we have every day, but it's that precise moment where they have the perfect balance between yin and yang, the perfect balance between day and night, between light and darkness. And it is a search for that balance and harmony and ultimately unity that the Korean people had when they waved that flag when they came out on the March 1st. And it is that spirit that led Ham Seok-hwan to become a Quaker and travel all the way here in 1916 and every year since, actually, to Philadelphia. And that is that with that spirit that I am here, thanks to Hope's invitation. Thank you.
And I'll paraphrase it. It says, Japan has become utterly corrupt within a short time after its political, after its liberation from Japan. The political hustlers who come stage overnight, claiming to represent the people without ever being invited to do so. Is he referring to the provisional government of Korea, or is he referring to the Korean Interim Legislative Assembly? Do you know?
What line is it?
So if you look at the first full paragraph, and you go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, lines 5 through maybe 10.
Oh, this is talking about after the liberation from Japan.
Yes.
So this is not the provisional government, but Syngman Rhee's regime since 1948.
Okay. All right. So for the first 3 years of occupation, he's not talking about that. Because that's what I'm thinking. Okay, the liberation, right? The U.S. came in and liberated.
When we say liberation, we mean 1945.
You mean 45.
So when the Americans came in is
45.
Is liberation. Yeah.
Right. So that's my question.
Right.
You know, right? So was it the provisional government, because they came in, but then you had, after that, you had the Korean Interim Legislative Assembly, where the Korean headmen appointed 45 people, and the U.S. government appointed 45 people, of which 4 were women, which is pretty fascinating in and of itself, yes.
Okay.
So that's my question, you know. Who is he referring to, if you know? Because I don't know, that's why I'm asking. And I saw this and I thought, ding, 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 fascinating.
I mean, I can't be too sure, but when we say provisional government, we mean the government that was established in 1919. So the government that came into being in 1945, we call it the American military government. and the government came into being in 1948 is the Republic of Korea. So he's not probably talking about the provisional government, which was born as a result of March 1st. He's probably talking about, and when we talk about Syngman Rhee, we sort of see it as a continuation of the Americans, because that's what he was.
Right.
So he probably is not trying to differentiate between the Americans and Syngman Rhee.
Okay, right. Okay, thank you very
much. I'm not sure, but yeah.
Yeah, and just in terms of dates, so 1945, liberation.
Yes.
And as you mentioned, Syngman Rhee is elected 75 years ago this year in 1948.
Yes.
So.
To my part later.
Yes, correct. It's just.
So I agree. That was a lucid and yet very weighty interpretation that. I appreciate it because I've read it twice. The second time I understood a little bit better, but it wasn't as lucid. It wasn't, still wasn't lucid. But you pulled it together very well. I was struck by how similar some of the language in the essay is to the language of the cohort that I talked about right before lunch. And yet the ethos underlying it is entirely different. Mm. Ham Sokhun is in line with Gandhi, in line with Tolstoy, somebody who is utterly anti-institutionalist, who sees the material world as an impediment to the fulfillment of human purpose and destiny. Whereas a Tsunajiro Miyaoka or a Nicholas Murray Butler or a Destronel de Constant, they, well, first of all, they are literally of these institutions. They believe, and we could go back to the Declaration of Sentiments as well, there is an implicit acceptance that human institutions are beneficial and can be reformed and improved. And in some cases, then, are worth fighting for. But when you get to Ham Sokhun, or a Gandhi, and a Tolstoy, these institutions are not worth fighting for. These institutions are corrupt. It doesn't matter whether it's Syngman Rhee or the provisional government. Mm-hmm. What is corrupt is the idea that these institutions can be perfected to get humans to a place of peace. And yesterday we made the observation of how complex this idea of peace is. And people who claim to be pacifists, that can mean different things depending upon which pew you're sitting in. So I mean that's a comment, but I it's a comment that's inviting commentary from you about whether the common ideas and yet the fundamental distinctions that I'm discerning in these different discourses are accurate, or your understanding of it.
I agree with your point about Ham Sokhun and Gandhi and all this tradition of sort of. Somewhat anarchist-leaning pacifism, all the way from Shelley, Tolstoy, has similarities with what Ham is doing, and I think is a fundamental sort of reaction to the Enlightenment belief in human perfectibility, that light will eventually conquer darkness, and humans, through some kind of progress, could be perfect or be at least made perfect. And Ham, I think, is definitely taking cues from Gandhi and Tolstoy, but also he is just going back to the ancient Eastern ideas of Taoism and Buddhism. The way he see the history of Korea as a history of suffering is essentially Buddhist. And the way he explains the concept of unity is very Chinese, that the Confucian and Taoist ideas about the yin and yang. Yang is never to conquer yin, right? Light is never to conquer darkness. They form a single unity. So this fundamental sense of the oneness of all things is what drives him. And if I may, this is a very peculiar Korean religious view. And that is the reason why the Protestant, the Christians, could join forces with Donghak. It's because in Korean, when we talk about God, we use the word 하나님, which is different from God. It literally means one being. Protestants say 하나님, Catholics say 하느님. 하느님 is heaven being. But Hamzok Khan uses the word 하나님, which is one being. And when he says 하나님, 하나님 is that all-encompassing, all-embracing being that has both light and darkness, both good and evil in it. And it means everyone, all living beings and non-living beings on this planet and the universe are ultimately one. That is the fundamental religious position that he holds, and that is also the fundamental religious position he sees in Quakerism. And he also sees the same thing in Donghak, which is really the foundational idea of the Republic of Korea, at least for the March 1st. So this sort of view on 하나님, which is a very, I would argue, a Korean sort of spiritual tradition, is what really drives him. So his main motive is to overcome the binary divisions, all the binary divisions that the modern world has brought. And his only way he sees out of that enlightenment sort of imperialist ideas about light conquering darkness or good versus evil is to just realize the fundamental oneness of all things. And that I would think is very much Taoist or Confucian.
Backward in that, in not endorsing this oneness view, but you know, as you talk about being on the DMZ and looking north, and you know, how can we, you know, sit in judgment? I'm a lawyer by training, and in law we are a little more binary. And you mentioned Ukraine. I mean, in just to, you know, expand a little that you know, the aggressor in. Under the UN Charter, which is, I think, our greatest instrument preserving peace and security since 1945, the aggressor state is the wrong state. So the UN Charter does take this binary view, and I think they're right. So I mean, nothing is, you know, completely without gray areas. You know, in the same way, you know, in the context of Nazi aggression, we would also recognize Soviet aggression and Allied war crimes. You know, I do realize there's not pure good and pure evil, and everything is complicated. But approaching from the law, it is binary, and we do have to make line drawing. And I realize a true pacifist would say, why are we even arming Ukraine? Like, we shouldn't even be doing that. But from a law perspective, Ukraine is fighting a war of self-defense, and that is permissible under the UN Charter. So, you know, I love the direction of your remarks, but I guess as a lawyer, I'm back at the UN Charter and believing there are some times we say, no, this is right and this is wrong. Anyway, that's just my reflection.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, yeah, I make those ethical decisions every day myself too. So it's, I don't think it was Hamas or any of the pacifist position to believe in moral relativism, to believe nothing is good or evil, but his more coming from the methodological perspective of how to bring peace. So previously, or we talked about John Brown or other sort of examples, in order to bring good results, a good end, a moral end, I would say violent or evil means were sometimes justified. And I pose the same question to the problem of Korea. Like, I see Kim Jong-un as an evil dictator. I believe that. But in order to bring about his end, or in order to bring about the liberation of the North Korean people, should I use violence? The exact sort of evil that I see in those people, right? So that's the question of the more effective method. But here, I don't think Ham is coming from a moral decision, like and Gandhi too. They're just being, look, this is the more effective way. We tried the violent way, and I would argue the Korean War was that example. We tried to use force. We brought it from the Americans, because we didn't have it enough. We tried to use force to pacify Korea, to bring good. But we all know what that led to. And we all know what the good intentions of using violence to bring about the end of the situation in Ukraine and is leading to too. So, and more importantly, as an animal rights activist, I know that there's no way that we can use violence to bring peace and justice to non-human animals and to the oceans and the mountains and the sort of the nature that we are destroying even as we speak. That's the more perpetual war that is going on. And so when it comes to that sort of planetary holistic perspective, there is really no option of using violence to bring peace, because it will never. And we have seen in history that it never did. That's why Ham argues we must but cannot resort to revolution, at least the political revolutions that we have been resorting to, but rather a more religious or spiritual revolution. And that's what I think Hope meant by Gandhi's Satyagraha, or the truth force, or the love force. We don't know exactly what that would bring about, but I think that's our only option, or at least that's the only option for Koreans. We don't have the power to take over North Korea or China, because they all have nuclear weapons, but we don't. There's not a chance for us.
And we'll just have one more question from Enid, but just to add to Professor Trahan's comment about the United Nations, Ham Sakhan actually refers to the United Nations in Queen of Suffering, and he is very laudatory of it, and he calls it a symbol of reason.
Well, everything you had to say was very deeply meaningful. In the ideal world, we would like to feel that people could see that our planet is being destroyed. And the reality is there is the political, which at times is hard, and I've been around a long time, hard for me to deal with. And I have a tendency to be idealistic and have hope. At times it's hard. And the idea of being attacked, how do you respond? So we respond with weapons. From your perspective, and maybe you've already said this, how do we change? Change takes time. How do we change? We would usually say you would hear men's minds, I will say people's minds, so that we get to the realization of, if we continue the way we're going, we will all be destroyed. And maybe one question you can elucidate on a little bit. I know you were very young, you were born in North Korea. We'll leave it at that, but you know more about your situation between North and South in the country, I think. We think we do, but you lived it. Or you know people that are living it. Do you really feel, and I'm asking you, you may not know the answer to this, that North Korea would, I don't know if you use the word crazy enough, because that's not true. They may believe in what they're doing. To really use nuclear weapons to the point, I mean, they're getting a little bit more risky as time goes on. Do you feel that they really care about whether or not doing something risky and destroying the world, do they care? Does it really matter?
I think it's two questions. How do we make change, and do we think North Korea is rational?
Yeah.
And the second question, we get that a lot, because the Western media portrayal of Kim Jong-un and North Korea is always quite caricature-esque. We think Kim Jong-un is crazy, the madman, friends with Dennis Rodman and stuff. And I think that's a huge mistake to think they're not rational. They are, in fact, if you look closely to what they're doing, they're extremely rational in everything they do in order to preserve their regime. So this is not a rational thing from the perspective of the people, but from Kim family, everything they do, including developing the nuclear weapon and actually thinking of using it when necessary, is extremely rational for the preservation of their status quo. So do I think they might use the nuclear weapon when, for example, Bill Clinton wanted to attack North Korea last time in the 90s when they first developed the nuclear weapons. If America were to do that again, or at least actually try to do that this time, I think they might. I think North Korea might use nuclear weapons. As long as it can guarantee, or at least as long as they think it can guarantee the continuation of their regime. So, and this is a very important point. Yes, they're all brainwashed, but the North Korean people genuinely think, at least most of them, genuinely think they're on the good side. This is something that we often forget. Most of them genuinely think they're on the good side. So they're exactly on the same position as I am in that sense. So how do I bring about changes in this kind of world? Well, I face that question every day myself when I deal with my partner. And she happens to be here right now. Whenever I have arguments with her, or whenever I have arguments with my family members or my closest friends, I have the same questions. How am I going to bring about changes, right? But we all know the answer. It's not violence. It's not killing them, obviously. It's not using violence against them, right? It's about changing myself first, right? And therefore changing the relationship. I think that is, in a nutshell, that is really the basics of the nonviolent method of bringing peace. It has to start from the family and to the state and to the world, which, by the way, is a very Confucian way of looking at things, starting from the family and building up to the world. But that is really, I think, what Hamsa Khan is arguing for, too. It's just treat North Korea as if you would treat your partner that is still not divorcing you, but is not willing to be in the same house as you are. You know, like, what do you do about that? I guess we have to go to go see a therapist first, but, you know, I don't know who will be that therapist. Oh, I don't know. Well, we'll have to hope for the best.
I think it's a good time, actually, to transition to Juman, who was going to sort of lead a stock-taking in Rapp, who's a political science professor. And so thank you so much, Bumsan. Yes.